Welcome to the Seahawkers Podcast, your Seattle Seahawks podcast by 12s for 12s. With your hosts, Adam Emmert.
You know what you do when life gives you lemons? You don't make lemonade. You kick life in the balls and you demand it gives you something better, like bacon.
Bacon's delicious.
And Brandon Schultz.
If you want to put your money toward helping this team win, buy a ticket to the game on Sunday and bring your adult voice and scream your adult brains out. That will make 10 times more the difference.
Go Hawks!
Be on a quest to own the West. We make the ground shake on game day 12-10. Yay's feeling it is vital. The Seahawks coming to take division titles. We are Coach Carroll, cause he's in. I'm in. We all in.
Welcome to the Seahawkers Podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz, member of the Military Seahawkers. Joining me, my good buddy, Adam Emmert.
You know, we're going to put out a show for you this week, but we're still treating it as an off week. We're going to let a lot of other people do the heavy lifting on this show. And but I think you guys, you'll get a nice break from Brandon and I to a degree, because we've got a lot of cool guests this week.
We do have a lot of cool guests. It's episode 112, Adam. And when you think, it's the 100th anniversary of our 12th show. And that was, you know, we a good show. We had Joe Tafoya on for that one. And now I think we have to bring on a lot of 12s to kind of fill out this show.
I think so. It's only fitting. No doubt about it. Or would our 100th anniversary of our 12th show, wouldn't that be like 100 times you've gone 12 shows? You know what I mean? Like 12, 24, 36.
That sounds like way too much math. I think 12 plus 100 is much easier.
Okay, fair enough. I just double checking. I don't know how anniversaries work. That's why I've ruined every relationship I've ever been in.
But it makes me think, though, when we get to episode 144, that that'll have to be a milestone too, because it'll be the 12th.
Yeah. See, now there, that seems to jive more for me, but I don't know.
We should get right into it, because we have an interview with Earl Lockett, Ricardo Lockett's father. He was at Ricardo Lockett's press conference announcing his retirement, and got to kind of get his perspective. And, you know, because as a father, you and I are both dads, and it's got to be tough, you know, when you see your kids be, well, for one, to go through an injury like Ricardo did on the field.
Oh, man.
And then to be a part of that play that shall not be spoken of in the Super Bowl.
Right.
And I kind of want to get his thoughts and perspective just on what Ricardo's been through and how it's been for him. And then I also want to bring on Rob Staton, Adam, because we've talked about the draft, and I think we need to get kind of his perspective on some of these guys. He follows a lot of the college football guys, right? So all the players that he knows these guys. So I kind of want to get an idea just what he thinks about this particular draft and how it shaped up to him. And also, he was the one that nailed the Jermaine Ifedi pick. So I think we have to give him some props.
Yeah, he took the words right out of my mouth, man. If I were him, I'm gloating all day long about that one.
Right, because since, what, 2010, has anybody ever picked the first player that the Seahawks were going to take in the draft? Anybody?
Nope. No, that's a true fact. That's a true fact. I don't know that there's been one living soul that said it other than John Schneider himself.
Exactly. So, and we're also going to have Norb Cowhealy and Mark Collins. They have an event coming up on Sunday, the 22nd, after the Seahawkers banquet. They're putting together a Seahawks fan event, and I want to talk to those guys. And of course, Mark Collins, he's well known for kind of that Save Our Seahawks movement back in the 90s. And we haven't had him on yet, Adam, and I think we should talk about this.
Absolutely. Mark is an incredible guy and an amazing 12. And then also with Norb, I mean, those are two of the biggest 12s of all time, right? Norb with his amazing videos on YouTube, Norb Cam. I mean, geez Louise, they're almost like crown royalty for 12s, right?
I think you have to, you know, put them amongst the well-known Seahawks fans that are out there. And so we'll talk to those guys, and then we have Seahawkers president Paul Gates, who's coming on the show as well. So it's a huge lineup.
It is. Everybody was excited to talk Hawks this week because I think everybody's going through withdrawals, you know? Like, they were ready to talk little Hawks. But, Paul's going to talk a little bit about the Seahawkers banquet that's coming up next weekend, which we will be attending. And that'll be super cool.
So let's get right into it. Let's bring on Earl Lockett. He is the father of Ricardo Lockett. And he was at the press conference right up there on the podium, sitting next to his son, while going through that retirement announcement. Earl, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Appreciate it.
Like I mentioned, Ricardo retired from football Thursday afternoon in a press conference. You were there. What were some of the emotions going through you while your son announced his retirement?
Oh, wow. Of course, you know, we've pondered what Ricardo would do for quite some time as far as finishing his career and giving us some thought. But so we were pretty much in agreement for quite some time that he would retire. But, you know, we came in thinking, okay, we're going to go and do this, and we're going to ponder through this. Never did we imagine how well we would be received. We walked in. It was a room full of press, well-wishers, coaches, teammates. And what really got us, and especially Ricardo, is when we walked in and they had a video of all of his big plays during the course of his career, and he heard his coaches and his teammates give us some insight on what they felt about Ricardo and how he impacted the game and them as a team and an organization. And that really got to him. But we were overjoyed at the support that we got from the Seattle organization and the team, especially the 12s. We had fans that even got wind that everything was going on, and we saw a lot of them as well.
I think, you know, for Seahawks fans, you know, you talked about all the people there that were there to wish him well, all the coaches. You know, I think of myself as a Seahawks fan. I think of the role that Ricardo had as a gunner on special teams, and that's really what endeared him to Seahawks fans. You know, the way that he played, how hard he played, the impact he had. It actually started a running thread on the show, Earl, over and over, of where the origin of the term gunner comes from. Do you know?
I do not.
Dang it.
It's a mystery that cannot be solved. Nobody knows.
I thought, if anything, you know, you coached Ricardo. You were his first coach. So how has it been like for you, just seeing the adversity that he's gone through, bouncing from team to team in college, going undrafted? You know, he was part of the play that Seahawks fans don't like to talk about in the Super Bowl, and then going to one of the worst injuries on the field we've ever seen. What has that all been like for you?
Oh, wow. It's been a blessing in disguise, and I say this, and I know you may seem alarmed, but there's different things that has happened to Ricardo in the past. I mean, even his path to the NFL, he never got anything easy. Everything he's accomplished has always had a loophole. It always had some type of pitfall. But through it all, it made him a stronger and courageous person. We even discussed before he went in to retire how God had prepared him. When he got up off the field that game with New England after that play, he said when he got up, the play was over. But we thought about that thing, and he said, Dad, if I could get up from that, that was only preparation to do something that would even be bigger. And, you know, in his career, we never thought it would be that. But the thing is, adversity has been his next-door neighbor, you know. So after a point in time, even though your next-door neighbor kind of gets on your nerves and offends you, you get to know him, and you get to learn how to deal with it. So when it becomes a second nature, I have been amazed at how my son has received so many different setbacks and he always looked to, you know, around the corner. He always looking for what's next. And so when he decided to retire, he immediately went into that mode about what would he do next and how would his life be different but better. So that injury, you know, he was prepared for it before he even knew it would happen. And how he received it was as courageous as I can imagine.
Well, and how about that, too? At the press conference, it was like he was talking about already moving on to the next thing, you know, and he talked about how, you know, helping homeless folks and helping kids that, you know, just need that extra little push to get to where they need to be. You know, he talked about the impacting that kid that might be the one that cures cancer, you know, having that kind of impact on people. How has that impressed you, just kind of his perspective of where he's at right now?
Well, you know, you teach kids right from wrong. You teach them good character skills all along. And it's just real rewarding when you see it in action, especially at such a high level as, you know, with Ricardo having the platform with the NFL to do the things that, you know, the guy around the corner does, that good guy that you know in the neighborhood. But Ricardo has great character, and I'm not surprised by any of those things. But what makes him great is that so many people now know about him. You know, these are the things that me and his mom, his grandparents, his aunts, uncles, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. All of the people that he has encountered in his child-raising days, they all taking part in who he is. But we're just glad that so many people know how great a person he is inside.
Now, Earl, you mentioned a little bit about the reception that you guys got yesterday and the amount of people that were there to support Ricardo at his retirement announcement. We hear a lot about the Seahawks being very much a brotherhood, the players themselves being very tight. Is that something, as you've seen Ricardo's career kind of go on, where he's been on some other teams, is it really different here? What is that relationship like, and what has that meant to Ricardo?
It is so real, and you know, you're definitely right. It's something that is within this organization. He has been other places, and it hasn't been the same by no means. I'll tell you that they are a family. I love what Pete Carroll and John Snyder and Paul Allen have done with this first-class elite organization that they're running. It's a family. I'll give you one of the biggest examples of that is, you remember the play where Marshawn ran down the field, Ricardo blocked for him about three or four times when they played the Cardinals, I think it was. You know, I've been talking and coaching Ricardo to always make yourself useful in a play, regardless of if you are running or catching, you know, whatever part, you know, do your part. And so I was like, that was a great example, son, of you going in there and being useful. You continue to play the whole play out, and that was great. He said, Dad, you know, thank you, but that really wasn't what I was thinking about at all. And I said, wow, well, what were you thinking? He said, all I saw was my brother down there, and he needed my help. And I mean, that was almost tear-jerking to me. They have that kind of relationship that he just wanted to help his brother. And, you know, it's evident because that same brother, we're talking Marshawn Lynch, when Ricardo was hurt in the hospital, a nurse came to me and she said, Mr. Lockett, I hate to interrupt you, but there's a gentleman outside. I don't know much about football, but he says he has to be in here. And I said, well, who is the gentleman? She said, his name is Marshawn Lynch, I think. And I said, wow. Marshawn was out there. Marshawn would not leave Dallas after Ricardo's injury. Even in tears, he was right there, and he lifted my son's spirits, I mean, in a way that we couldn't imagine. And that kind of brotherhood, that kind of camaraderie has just been great. Another great incident is when Paul sent the private jet to pick up Ricardo from Dallas. He didn't have to do that. But that's just the family organization that they have established. And I look at Seattle Seahawks, the 12. I don't look at it as a place where my son played. I look at it as an extended family from my home, and we love them all the way back in Albany, Georgia. We love Seattle in a special way. This has been a special part of our lives, and we would never, never forget them.
So when I look at all that adversity, Earl, that Ricardo's gone through just throughout his career, you know, for parents who want to have those kind of values of continuing to fight when the times are toughest, is that something that you can teach your kid, or is that just something that Ricardo has in him?
Well, you definitely teach. I think he hit the nail on the head in his interview. He said that how we mattered as parents, but we put the confidence there. We said, you can do this. You're great. You can be whatever you want to be. Then I think it's left up to the individual to go out and to use that. Now, sometimes all we need is that push. True enough, you have to have it within. But I think it's very important, very essential that as parents that you continue to support your kids and be the first cheerleader, the first coach, humble bearer in their lives. And then you can see, you know, be it whatever profession they choose, that they'll be fine.
Well, Earl, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Really thank you for offering your perspective on yesterday at the press conference. And, you know, definitely you're part of the Seahawks family now for forever. And we're really glad that we got to see your son play in a Seahawks uniform and everything he did for the team as well.
Well, I'll tell you, it's been a wonderful experience. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. And we love the 12. Go Hawks, baby.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Well, a big thanks to Earl Lockett for coming on the show. And Adam, any big takeaways from me from that, from his thoughts?
Well, number one is just the positivity. I mean, the man watched his son have his skull detached from his spine.
Right.
And watched the difficult transition and healing process to even get to where he is now. And yet still just thankful for the experience that they had in the game. The thankful for the people that they've been, able to participate with in the game, and just so thankful for the Seahawks organization as a whole and the way they've kind of treated Ricardo. The positivity is just, that's phenomenal to me. Phenomenal.
It was neat to hear him tell the story about Marshawn being there at the hospital room, because I think we had known that Marshawn spent a lot of time with him at the hospital after that game. But you didn't really get that other perspective of, you know, just how much it meant to him that he was the guy at the door and he wasn't going anywhere. And then for the nurse not to know, you know,
yeah.
For guys like us who are so into the game, you realize that, yeah, there's a lot of people that don't even watch football. You wouldn't know who they are. And and to her, it was just like, here's some guy that he's not going away. What do you want me to do?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Yeah, what do you want me to do with this Hulk of a man? Do I throw him out or not? You know,
right.
But no, that was super cool. You know, the other thing that he touched on a couple times was you know, the support of Pete and John, and then, but he also mentioned Paul Allen a couple times, and you don't hear a lot about ownership in sports in some ways, unless it's like Jerry Jones, right?
Right.
Like, you know, some of the celebrity owners, but you don't hear about owners really taking the time to, you know, really care about their players in the sense that send a private plane down there. He's absolutely right. Didn't have to do that.
Right.
Or you know, just any of the other things behind the scenes. I thought that was really cool because we do have a first class owner, and you could hear from what Earl said that, you know, they feel very much the same way about that.
Well, thanks again to Earl for coming on. And Adam, what do you say we get into our conversation with Rob Staton as we look back and get his perspective on the draft? And I want to get just an idea from him of why maybe we didn't cover some of these players.
Perfect. That sounds good, man.
Now joining us, our Seahawks draft expert from Sheffield, England, Rob Staton of Seahawks Draft Blog and the 3000 NFL Mock Draft Podcast. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So I think the last time, Rob, anybody correctly guessed who the Seahawks were going to take with their first pick in any draft was back when they took Russell Okung back in 2010, and it was an obvious need with a player with clear talent where the Seahawks had a need. But it's a lot more challenging when the Seahawks are at the bottom of the first round or having to wait until the second round like these past few years. Yet, Rob, this year, you came up with a formula. You knew what the Seahawks needed in either offense or defensive line, and you nailed the pick. The Seahawks take Jermaine Ifedi, the tackle from Texas A&M. How did it feel to see that pick come in?
Well, you know, if, more than anything, it felt good because I think that Jermaine Ifedi is going to be a really good player for the Seahawks because it's very rare that late in the first round you find a guy with his level of athleticism, his length, his size, at the end of the first round. You know, generally these types of players go very early. I think that he gets a bit of a bad rap. I think a lot of the media were very critical of Jermaine Ifedi and the way that he performed. Yet when you watch him play against teams like Alabama last season, I thought he played pretty well. So I think it was pretty rare for the Seahawks to find somebody like him late in the first round. I think they've got a really good pick there. And yeah, he does sort of fit the formula. You know, they like length, they like explosive offensive linemen, and he ticks a lot of those boxes. He's going to start at right guard, it looks like, initially. But it wouldn't be a big surprise if eventually he moved over to right tackle, maybe even left tackle for the Seahawks, because he has pretty much everything that you look for in an NFL tackle.
Well, you talk about the media that were critical of the pick. The one that stands out in my mind, Pro Football Focus, said that they had him projected a sixth round talent in their eyes. What did you think of that when they had Jermaine Ifedi as the worst pick of the first round of the NFL draft?
Yeah, I'd love to see the 200 prospects they rank ahead of Jermaine Ifedi if he's a sixth round prospect. I mean, this is the thing with Pro Football Focus, is that there is a use for stuff like this. But when they start saying things like Jermaine Ifedi is a sixth round prospect, you kind of have to say you're going too far. And you look at some of the ways that they grade. Essentially, it's just a guy watching tape and he grades how he thinks a particular prospect has done. And PFF, they don't know what the guy's role is necessarily. I thought there was some great stuff from, I think it was it Jeff Schwartz, actually, the former New York Giants lineman, who was saying, like, you know, you've sort of diagnosed that this is what is supposed to happen on this play. And he was sort of tweeting, this was my job here, or this was this guy's job here, and you've kind of got that wrong. And when you sort of see PFF, they graded a 5-touchdown performance by Aaron Rodgers against Kansas City last year as a negative performance. I think Earl Thomas was the 29th ranked safety in 2012. There's a lot of stuff like that. I mean, the Seahawks, I think, in a game, I'm trying to remember which game it was last year, maybe something like the Cleveland game or something like that, when they ran all over. Oh, no, it was the Arizona game. It was the Arizona game in week 16 where they ran all over the Cardinals and won the game at a canter. And the Seahawks got a negative grade for run blocking and the Arizona Cardinals defense got a plus grade. And you're thinking, well, you know, it was a totally one-sided performance. So while, you know, Pro Football Focus has definitely got a use and it's interesting and some of their stuff is very interesting to read, particularly on pass rushes, I think, because we tend to judge pass rushes on sacks. Mm-hmm. And some of their studies on, you know, impact and splash plays is pretty interesting. But in terms of Jermaine Ifedi being a sixth-round prospect, I think I'll sort of just walk past that one and ignore it.
sounds like a plan. Now, one guy we kind of ignored, Rob, is Jaron Reed. And I think part of the reason for that is we didn't think he'd be available at the bottom of the first round. Yet, the Seahawks get him toward the middle of the second round. They trade up to get him at pick number 49. How did you feel about that pick?
I think it's a fantastic pick. Did not expect him at all to be available that late. Clearly the Seahawks didn't either. I remember seeing the body language of John Schneider as they had made the trade and did the pick, and he kind of shrugged his shoulders in utter disbelief, really, that they'd been able to pull it off. I had him at number 16 to Detroit in the first round. I think a lot of people have said, you know, people like Mike Mayock and Daniel Jeremiah were ranking this guy in the top 20. Mm-hmm. And if you were to just grade him on what he does, he is a top 20 type talent. I mean, he does not, if you want a run defender, this is the guy you need. I mean, he doesn't move off the line of scrimmage. You know, he would take on a double team, plant his legs like a tree, and just, you could not move him off the line of scrimmage. And because the Seahawks play so much on gap discipline, gap control, doing your job, run defense, in base defense. You know, this type of player is like gold dust for them. I bet they were very, very tempted to take Jaron Reed in the first round, and probably would have done at a pinch if it wasn't for the fact that they desperately needed some offensive line help. So to get him at number 49, and all they had to do was give up a fourth round pick to trade up for him, is terrific. And I think that watching him play, he definitely has an element of explosion to him. And I think there's a bit more sort of pass rushing ability in there that than we saw necessarily at Alabama, where he only played something like 60% of the snaps, I think. So they kept him fresh. They kept him on rundowns. I think if the Seahawks use him that way, I think they'll mix him up a little bit. They'll play him at the one, the three, and the five. And they'll get him sort of moving across the line, attacking at different angles. And I think that he's actually going to be a better pass rusher than people think. Still pretty much going to be a base defender, but I think this is tremendous value. And he could end up being a core player for the Seahawks over the next few years.
And when people talk about that ability that he had at Alabama, it wasn't necessarily that he was asked to rush the passer, right? And that's kind of why people think that he has that upside as potentially as a pass rusher.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing we've got to remember with Alabama is that they generally, like, you know, like USC did with Pete Carroll, is they just stash 5- and 4-star recruits. So if they have Jaron Reed and A'shaun Robinson in there working the run defense, they can look at people like Jonathan Allen and Tim Williams. I think Tim Williams played something like 30% of the snaps. He's going to be a potential top 10 pick next year, just a pure pass rusher. So they had a lot of guys. I mean, they've got guys coming through who we're going to sort of see in the next year for Alabama, who could easily go on and be first round picks, who are playing sort of like rotational backup roles. So you can afford to say to someone like Jaron Reed, just work on the run defense. That's all we want you to do. Be stout. Don't give up anything in the run game. And then we're going to pull you out and put Tim Williams on the field. I mean, he wasn't asked to do much pass rushing. So we'll see what he can do in camp. The Seahawks might be able to coax a little bit more out of him in terms of a pass rusher. And if that's the case, then, you know, in a few years' time, we could be looking at this pick as a huge steal. Remember that Kawan Short went at the sort of the top of the second round to Carolina and ended up being one of the best defensive tackles in the league. It won't be a huge shock if Jaron Reed has something similar there.
So we didn't talk much about Reed. Another guy, or a position really, that we didn't talk much about was tight end. And the Seahawks, thanks to that draft pick, moving down from Jermaine Ifedi, moving down from 26 to 31, they pick up the Broncos' third-round pick, and they take tight end Nick Vannett.
Yeah, and I didn't expect them to take a tight end, and that was a big mistake on my behalf. I mean, I generally thought that because they had Jimmy Graham, because they had Luke Wilson, and sort of the way that they seemed to have looked at sort of Cooper Helfert and sort of the way that they seem to have a lot of time for him, I thought they'd probably say, okay, we can stick with Helfert and Wilson for now, wait for Jimmy Graham to get healthy and then just roll with that. Plus, the other thing is that college tight ends are not very good these days. I mean, there's a reason why the Seahawks traded for Jimmy Graham, and that's right, because there aren't many Jimmy Grahams around. So I didn't expect them to go for something like this. I kind of wrongly ignored Nick Vannett and what he would bring to the table. I've had a chance to sort of go and have a look at him after the draft and watch two of his games. And in particular, if people want to sort of see what he's all about and the reason why the Seahawks have drafted him, I would recommend finding his tape, which is available online, against Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl, where he didn't do much route running, and I think his routes are kind of, they need development there. There's not a lot of snap in his short range routes as well. So in terms of the passing game, he's got a lot of work to do there. I don't think he hits the seam as well as he can, doesn't create much separation against linebackers, but as a blocker, just fantastic. He didn't miss a single block in that game. I mean, he was being asked to line up 1v1 and maybe play as an extra tackle. He was being asked to sort of pull around and hit a target on the move. He was being asked to get to the second level and block linebackers, and he would identify his guy, latch on, and execute the block. It's a really difficult skill, and it's something you don't see a lot of in college. You just don't see players playing this way. The orthodox tight end has been sort of taken away from the college game as the spread offense has become more dominant, and I think it's great that Ohio State, they're very much a run team. If they're not getting the quarterback to run, they're getting Zeke Elliott to run. So they clearly felt there was some benefit in having a tight end like that. They used Nick Vannett almost predominantly as a blocker. I think that he's going to produce some instant impact there. especially when he lines up as that extra tackle and as an option to in the passing game to sort of be a deceptive weapon in that regard. I also think he's going to offer some. I don't think he's going to offer much in terms of third down conversion or a lot of the stuff that Graham and Wilson are good at. But I think in the red zone, because of his size, I think he's got the longest wingspan from a tight end to enter the league in several years. So wingspan and size and catch radius could be a big thing in the red zone.
Well, if there's one thing that the Seahawks made clear with the Vinette pick is that they are still going to be a running team. The other thing that made it clear, they took three running backs, Rob, and three running. If there's one area where I feel like people are being critical of the Seahawks draft, it's the fact that they took three running backs throughout the draft when it seemed like perhaps they had other needs at different positions. How did you feel when you saw three running backs come off the board? CJ Procise in the third, Alex Collins in the fifth, and then Zach Brooks in the seventh.
I was very comfortable with it because I, for one reason or another, I've spent a lot of time looking at the first two guys, and I had spent some time looking at Zach Brooks because he had a visit with the Seahawks, so he was linked to them a little bit, so there was a reason to go and look at him. On Procise, I mean, he's been compared to Matt Forte. I think he's a lot more fluid and a bit more natural as a runner than Matt Forte. Terrific hands. You know, he doesn't go out of bounds. He will drive through defenders, very much a Seahawks type of running back in terms of size and fluidity. If he had to come in for Thomas Rawls and spell a little bit, then he could do that. But I think his great value is going to be that he's kind of like the ideal third down, two-minute offense back. And the Seahawks have really developed a good two-minute offense over the years. I mean, if you remember, Robert Turbin used to do that role. Fred Jackson kind of did it last year. When they need to move the ball towards the end of a half, they've generally done it. I mean, they've actually had games where they've struggled on offense in the first half. And then when it gets to the two-minute drill and quicken things up, all of a sudden they start moving the ball and you kind of sort of take that into the second half and that momentum. So I think Procise is going to help them do that in a much better way than, you know, as good as Fred Jackson is as a player and was as a player. Procise is younger, fresher, more athletic. He's going to scare teams as well. I mean, he could take a little wheel route to the left and take it to the house for 60 yards. He could just sort of convert a third down running over across, running sort of in from the slot inside on a slant. He could do that and get a third down conversion. I think that you could also, the one other thing that the Seahawks love to do is they love the empty backfield look. And I know a lot of fans probably cringe at that. You know, it gets a lot of criticism from Seahawks fans, but it's a look the Seahawks love to have. So you put Procise in the backfield, the defense maybe is in a run formation, they're expecting a run, and then you just split him outside. You've got a mismatch there because if the defense is lined up to defend the run and you've split the running back out wide, then although you're sort of showing your hand, this is going to be a pass, you're also saying we've got a matchup problem here. They can't cover this guy in the way that they want to, or they're going to cover him and they're going to leave someone like Jimmy Graham or Doug Baldwin open. So it provides a lot of options for the Seahawks to have an empty backfield look, and Procise is going to help them to do that. Quickly on the other two, Alex Collins is a player I just love. I mean, he's not Marshawn Lynch, but his running style is very similar. Short steps, power, will drive people into the end zone. There's a great play. If you've not seen it yet, Seahawks fans, go and look at it. Kansas State towards the end of last season, where he just sort of broke about five tackles and carried a pile into the end zone. Very Marshawn Lynch-esque. He's going to be a fun player for the Seahawks fans to follow in training camp. And Brooks, a bit like Procise, they clearly just like the guy and didn't want him to get away in undrafted free agency. They took him in the seventh round, and he's going to add to the competition. The Seahawks are a running team. They've got a number of guys in there. Kristen Michael's still there. Thomas Rawls is there. Why not have all these guys competing in training camp to see who's going to be one, two, and three?
Well, and I think that was part of the question, right? Is that, was this some kind of statement of how they feel about guys like Thomas Rawls and Kristen Michael when you bring in three brand new guys to compete with two guys that you kind of expected to be there. But now Kristen Michael has to be kind of worrying, I think, because clearly the team likes Thomas Rawls.
Yeah, Michael has to worry because he's the one who's under pressure here. Thomas Rawls is going to be the number one, health permitting, because he's warranted that. But the thing about Kristen Michael is he performed better last year when the pressure was really on. You know, this is your last chance. Mm-hmm. And he looked good. But he needs that pressure again in training camp. He can't settle into a number two role here. they want people, you know, really knocking on his door and saying, I want your job. So I think that's a good thing. And look, either way, it's going to work for the Seahawks. Either Kristen Michael's is going to win this job, and he's going to be convincing, and he's going to get that element of trust from the Seahawks coaches, or someone else is going to snatch that job away from him. And I think either way, the Seahawks are going to benefit.
So you mentioned that Seahawks fans generally don't like it when the Seahawks line up five wide. And I think part of the reason for that is that the linemen have trouble with the pass blocking part of that whole scenario. And people obviously know that the Seahawks are going to pass in that situation. But they went out and they got Jermaine Ifedi. They got Reese Odhiambo. Now, at number 97, Reese Odhiambo, not one of those guys, because of his injuries, he didn't have the numbers to plug into your trench explosion formula. Mm. But there were a lot of other guys at that number 97 pick where you look down that list and you see guys that have those that fit into that formula well, that would be Tom Cable, likely to be Tom Cable guys. What did you think of that particular pick?
I mean, it was not a total surprise, because Tony Pauline, who's a fantastic draft insider, had speculated the Seahawks really liked the guy because of the injuries, and because Pete Carroll had said that they wanted to get healthier first and foremost on the offensive line. I didn't think they would take him this early, but I think that's a good thing, because the fact that they did take him in the third round, despite Carroll saying we want to get healthy, suggests they really like him. So I'm not going to sort of see this as a negative thing. I do wonder, I mean, his ankle injury, I think it was pretty serious though when he did a lot of the testing. I don't think he was 100% healthy. I mean, his broad jump was one of the worst. And when you watch him play on tape, his footwork is fantastic. He always has the defender in front of him. He doesn't lose position in that regard. You want to see a bit more of a nastier edge at times from him, I think it's fair to say, but his footwork is great. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think if he's 100% healthy, he does a broad jump, which is a lot better than the sort of the 7 feet 10 or whatever it was that he jumped. Not a very good attempt. So I think that he was probably hurt, and that's part of the problem. But I watched a couple of minutes of a mic'd up session with Tom Cable, which anyone can see on Seahawks.com right now. I would recommend going and seeing this, because Tom Cable does a drill where he does like a triple block session. So he wants three linemen essentially blocking two guys, drive them off the ball, create that gap and let the running back explode. And as they're sort of doing this drill, Reese Odhiambo is one of the guys doing it. You can hear Tom Cable barking in the background, "O can do this, O can triple block." And then as soon as O is Odhiambo, and when he sort of finished this little drill, he came across and Tom Cable points at him and goes, "That was great," or something like that, and made a point of singling him out. This is a guy that Tom Cable just seems to be madly in love with as a player. And when you sort of consider his background, left tackle convert, that is what they've consistently started at left guard. You look at his size, his mobility, his potential to work out as a zone block scheme, guard or tackle. I would not be surprised at all. I know that a lot of people presume right now that Mark Glowinski is going to win the left guard job just because he's maybe got a year's experience. I will not be surprised. The way that Cable's sort of acting around this guy, and the way the Seahawks have talked about him, and the fact they took him in the third round, this to me makes me think that he's got a really good chance to win that left guard job.
Well, the way the competition is shaping up, it's really interesting, right? Because I think we did kind of pencil in Glowinski either for the right guard or the left guard position. And when Ifedi was picked and they said that they weren't going to put him at tackle, they were going to start him at right guard, that made you think, okay, well, Glowinski will get that left guard job. But like you're saying, Odhiambo, you can't rule out the fact that there might be competition there. And then where does that leave Justin Britt? Oh, they're going to try him out at center. That's going to leave a very big offensive line if you end up seeing Justin Britt at center, right?
Yeah, I mean, size would be fantastic. And, you know, Justin Britt's an interesting one, because the kind of assumption is with Seahawks fans that he's been a disaster and that he's a bust. But I will say this, that he was graded during the 2015 season as one of the best run-blocking offensive linemen at kind of at the midway point. And I think that a lot of the people who grade these things, it may even have been a PFF grade, were saying that he was the most improved offensive lineman as the season was going along. But then he has a pretty – I mean, it was a miserable performance against Carolina in the playoffs. I mean, if anyone's seen the All 22 tape, I think someone maybe on Field Goals broke this down, mm-hmm. but you can sort of see he was atrocious that day. And that sort of sticks with you going into the offseason. And he has the size. He's an explosive tackle. He does drive people off the ball in the run game, but his pass protection is awful, or has been so far. Now at center, the responsibility is completely different than guard. And if he's just sort of blocking one squaring up, you know, if he's just trying not to get blown off the ball, then that might actually suit him. Now I'm not convinced he's going to win that job. He's a very big player to play center. He's not done a great deal of snapping, although I think he has some center experience at Missouri. I wouldn't put him as the favorite to win that job by any stretch, but he has a shot. I mean, this is for me, that's the most wide open competition on the team going into camp. It's center. It's Justin Britt. It's Joey Hunt. It's Patrick Lewis. It's Christian Sicoli, Will Perichak. You know, there's a lot of options there for the Seahawks to kind of pick a guy. And any of those guys, I would not be surprised at all if any of them ended up getting the job.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Joey Hunt, because here's a guy where Justin Britt, we've talked about how he can't pass block. Joey Hunt, this is a guy that can actually pass block. Now, he's undersized. He was picked in the sixth round and singled out by Pete Carroll, John Schneider, as a guy that they couldn't come away from the draft without. Were you surprised to hear that?
A little bit, but then I kind of like thought about it a bit more, and I just wondered whether or not it was more a case of we have to add a center in this draft, and maybe he was the last center that they had a draftable grade on. Mm-hmm. So they kind of felt like if we don't take him, we're going to come out of this class without one. Mm-hmm. So I think with hindsight, because he was a sixth round pick, that's probably what they were meaning with that. Having seen Joey Hunt, I mean, there's a lot to like about his game. His second level blocking is superb. The Seahawks have used quite a lot of stretch plays, especially with Thomas Rawls. I mean, Rawls is a much better athlete, in fairness, than Marshawn Lynch. You know, you wouldn't run stretch with Marshawn Lynch that often because he's not got that sort of quick agility, quick twitch to sort of max out that. You want him sort of north and south. Mm-hmm. With Thomas Rawls, if you run a stretch, he can really exploit that. He can turn what would be potentially a 5-yard gain into a 20-yard gain. And the best sort of way to execute this, or the traditional, if you sort of read into it, the most traditional sense to make this play a success in the zone blocking scheme is to have real athleticism at center and left tackle. You know, a left tackle and a center that gets to the second level and more size on the right hand side. And it's perhaps not a coincidence that the Seahawks are looking to field Jermaine Ifedi and Jamarcus Webb at right guard and right tackle, and that they're maybe looking at more athletes to play left tackle and center. And when you look at Joey Hunt getting to the second level, you think, yeah, you know, this could be something the Seahawks really zone in on, you know, the stretch run play going into 2016. And Hunt does that very well. The one concern is he's got very short arms. I mean, I think the sub 31 inch arms, this is the first player the Seahawks have drafted under Carolyn Schneider, offensive lineman that is, with less than 33 inch arms. So he's a real anomaly based on what they've done in the past. And he's short as well. And when you actually watch him playing against length, he can be sort of pushed off balance. There was a couple of times in a couple of the games I saw where you're looking and he's almost on the deck because you get length into his frame, you can shove him back, he gets off balance, and he never really recovers because he can't, because he's not got the length and the response for that. But when he squares up, when he faces man-to-man in front of him, when he gets to the second level, he looks very accomplished. The one problem is that in the NFL, it's going to be a little bit dirtier and a bit nastier. He's not going to face guys 1v1. They're going to get around the outside. He's going to have to recover. His footwork's going to have to be great. He's going to have a great punch. He's going to have to compensate for his lack of length. These are all things that are working against him, which is why I don't think he's going to win the job necessarily as a rookie unless he comes in and absolutely nails everything very quickly. I think he might be a guy who's competing more next year. If I was going to sort of put money on anybody to start that position, I think Patrick Lewis will probably just carry on and then we'll sort of reassess this position in a year's time.
Well, the last pick, Rob, that we haven't talked about, Kenny Lawler, wide receiver out of Cal, catching passes from the number one pick. Lawler goes all the way in the seventh round. Did you expect him to be an undrafted guy, or did he fall a little bit farther than you would have expected him?
I thought he was going to go into like the fourth or fifth round range. When you watch him play, he was terrific for Cal. I mean, like Jared Goff should send this guy a birthday card, even though they're playing for different teams. Because, you know, there was Goff's a good quarterback. You know, whether or not he's worth what the Rams gave up for him or not will be seen. But, you know, he bailed Jared Goff out a lot with some really great contested catches. And if there's one thing the Seahawks love, it's high points in the football, winning contested grabs, winning the red line, and body control as a receiver. And he's not the quickest guy. He's not the most athletic. He's not the biggest. But he catches the ball, and his character, and he's gritty, and he's consistent, and he makes big plays. The Seahawks have, with Ricardo Lockett retiring and with Chris Matthews moving on, they haven't really got a taller receiver who can make big, big chunk plays downfield. Mm-hmm. They have usually carried somebody who has no impact for 4 weeks or something like that. You know, like 4 or 5 weeks, doesn't have a catch. But then there'll come a game when all of a sudden this random guy gets a 50-yard touchdown grab. And that used to be Ricardo Lockett. I mean, if you think to the Denver game, mm-hmm. In 2014, he had a fantastic downfield reception against the Broncos, which came from nowhere. Last year against Carolina, he was the recipient of the flea flicker,
right?
From Russell Wilson. You know, they need somebody who can do that. And I think that Kenny Lawler is a guy who potentially could do that because of the way that he plucks the ball out the air, the way he competes for the ball in the air. So I think he's got a decent chance to make the roster and then have an impact pretty quickly. But if he's going to do that, he's competing with the likes of Kevin Smith, Kaysom Williams, people like that. So he's going to have to maybe win the job with great special teams play as well. And I think if he's going to do that, he has to get bigger. He's looking very, very skinny at the moment. So he needs to get bigger, stronger, and prove that he can do stuff on special teams as well to warrant, I think, beating out other guys on the roster.
Well, that was the other interesting thing about Lawler, right, is that when the Seahawks take wide receivers, it's either in the second or the third round when you have guys with clear talent, or they wait and get them as undrafted free agents. Mm. And this time they actually draft a guy toward the end of the draft as a wide receiver. And it just makes me wonder, why would Lawler go in the seventh? Is it because people don't see him as being able to replicate what he did in college against NFL talent? Or it's just curious to me why he slipped as far as he did.
I think two things here. First, I think the Seahawks are pretty smart in the seventh round, because I think that they knew who they wanted to get in undrafted free agency, and they took the guys in round seven they thought they probably couldn't get. Mm. Zach Brooks is probably not going to sign for this team as a free agent after they've drafted Alex Collins and CJ Procise. He'd probably go somewhere else. So they drafted him to make sure they got him. And with Kenny Lawler, it would have been pretty easy for the Rams to sort of say, okay, he's got that relationship with Jared Goff. Do you want to come and sign with us? And he probably would have done that. I mean, he's from California. He would have been a very obvious free agent signing for the Los Angeles Rams. Mm-hmm. So the Seahawks drafted these two guys, I think, because they knew that they'd struggle to get them in undrafted free agency. And then they targeted the linebackers, defensive linemen, stuff like that, who, you know, because they hadn't taken a linebacker, for example, in the draft. So they could then appeal to people like Montez Overton and Christian French and say, look, we haven't drafted anybody. Come and compete for this role. We've lost Bruce Irvin. We haven't replaced him. Here's your passage to become an NFL starter. And they didn't draft a safety either. So they could say the same to someone like Tyvus Powell. So that's the first thing on that. I think the other reason why Lawler fell is because he doesn't have anything apart from the hands. There's nothing that really stands out. So he's incredibly skinny. Can he get off press coverage? Teams will be worried about that. He doesn't have great speed, and you know, I guess they could say he's played with the number one pick at quarterback. So does that enhance his performance because he's playing with a great quarterback? I like to think of it the other way around, really. I think that he did a lot for Jared Goff.
Yeah.
But he has to get bigger. He's lost so much weight since the combine. I mean, he looks like the skinny 14-year-old who's going to the gym for the first time right now. I mean, his arms are incredibly thin. He needs to sort of get some bulk on that frame, because he's just not going to be able to beat press otherwise.
Well, you mentioned some of the names of the undrafted free agents, Rob. Are there any guys that really jump out at you as potential guys that come time for the 53-man roster, guys that will recognize their name as undrafted free agents?
A couple, really. I mean, Tyvus Powell is pretty much identical to Deion Buchanan as an athlete. Same size, same kind of speed. I thought he was going to go in sort of the fourth or fifth rounds. Was very surprised that he was there in free agency. And while I'm not anticipating he's going to be Deion Buchanan, for a team that has done so well finding not just role players, but starters in the free agent market, would not be a total surprise at all that if in a couple of years' time, Tyvus Powell is a pretty key player for the Seahawks. So that's one. The other one is Brandon Bryant. I mean, if you get a chance to sort of see his tape, there's some nice all 22 tape on him, which is on YouTube that you can find. His tape is sensational. I mean, he is a fantastic pass rusher, and he's not just doing it against, you know, smaller school teams. He did it against teams like Florida as well. So, you know, you watch him play and you think, this is it. They want to play this guy at fullback as well. You know, really exciting player to watch. And because there's an obvious passage for him, you know, to come in and be the Will Tukuafu for this team. You know, I really, really hope that he can pick up the whole fullback thing, because if they could find a fullback with his potential to play on the defensive line and wreak havoc as well, I mean, that would just be a tremendous get for the Seahawks.
Rob, great job as always coming on the show, breaking down the draft. I'm glad we were able to do it. People can follow you on Twitter at Rob Staton, S-T-A-T-O-N. They can follow you on SeahawksDraftBlog.com and also through the 3000 NFL Mock Draft podcast. Now that the draft season is kind of over, what can we expect from you in the coming months leading up to the Seahawks season?
Well, I like to take a break initially. I mean, I have a young son who is 2 years old, 2.5 now. So it's a nice time for me to spend some real quality time with him for the next few weeks. But then eventually, I mean, I'm ready for football right now. I mean, I'm kind of wishing my life away already for it to be September or even August. I'll take a preseason game at this point.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really looking forward to it. Eventually, down the line, I guess, in sort of when we get to the summer, we're going to start. I'm already just kind of looking at guys. You know, if they want a name from somebody to sort of go and have a look at, Jehu Chesson, who is a wide receiver from Michigan, is 6'3" and 210 pounds, and he's the kick returner for Michigan. He had a 96 yard touchdown return against Northwestern last year, and he does end arounds and stuff like that. I mean, this is kind of like having AJ Green doing all those things. So he's an incredible athlete for his size, and he's got a great attitude, great personality, and he's going to be well coached by Jim Harbaugh at Michigan. So if you have withdrawal symptoms kind of like me, and you need somebody to kind of go and watch, there's a load of highlights from last season on this guy on YouTube. If you need somebody to go and watch, then go and check him out, and maybe that'll occupy you for a couple of nights.
See, already looking ahead to the 2017 draft. Like it, Rob. Well, thanks again for coming on the show, and yeah, definitely check that out, SeahawksDraftBlog.com, 3000 NFL Mock Draft podcast, and yeah, at Rob Staton on Twitter. I gotta say, you were awfully quiet during that interview.
yeah.
Thanks to Rob Staton for coming back on the show, offering his perspective. And yeah, answering some of those questions that we were wondering, kind of watching the draft of what these players might be like. Rob knows because he watches.
That's exactly right. It's a step up from us who we do not watch college.
Right.
Because, you know, it's boring. So,
well, it's a lot of work to watch all those players. I mean, once we have it narrowed down to the guys that we know will be on the team, then we can start watching.
Right. Yeah. I just need somebody to, like, you know, cut it down for me a little bit. Like, I don't have time to be watching the whole, like, 14 leagues or whatever it is.
Well,
yeah.
John Schneider cut it down for you.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, John.
All right. Let's go from that to our next interview with Paul Gates, a.k.a. Bernie Hawk. Paul's the president of the Seahawkers Central Council. That's the group that heads up all of the Seahawks chapters around the world. And Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Brendan.
So how many chapters do we have now? You know, it's incredible the number of groups that we see popping up around the country, around the world. You know, we just started one here in Montana that Adam and I are a part of. You know, I'm also a part of the military chapter. So how many are we up to, even ballpark number?
Oh, that's fantastic that you guys are starting new chapters. And we have new chapters starting almost monthly. It feels like about every month, every 2 or 3 months, we're approving or putting a chapter on hold that they're going through all the steps to become official Seahawk booster clubs. But right now we're at about 54 with pending approval on another 2 or 3 maybe at our next meeting in June.
Well, and we have the Seahawkers annual banquet coming up, which I want to talk about. But before we do that, I want to know, we'd like to ask our fellow 12s just how they became Seahawks fans, because clearly you're a passionate fan, you know, Bernie Hawk, that you have that persona. But how did you become a Seahawks fan, Paul?
I grew up in Olympia, and pretty much, you know, I think I was a fan of like the Dolphins or the Colts or something like that when I was a little kid. But no, what was it, 1975, and the Seahawks, you know, Seattle announced that we're going to get a football team, and so I was right on board. And Jerry Lewis Telethon, I don't even know if you remember Brakeman Bill.
Oh, yeah.
He would host the Seattle push section of the Jerry Lewis Telethon, and I remember they had the first Seahawks football autographed by all the first players, and a helmet, the very first Seahawks, well, one of the first Seahawks helmets. And they were auctioning them off. So I told my dad I was going to borrow some money from him. I didn't tell him how much. And I bid $500 on the football, and I bid $1,000 on the helmet. Wow. And then I was really worried. So that was 14 years old. Well, I think the football went for like $10,000, and the helmet went for like $15,000 or $18,000. So, I mean, I didn't even have a chance. Didn't have a chance, but I'm somewhere in the archives as I bid on those items. That's my first Seahawks story.
As a 14-year-old, I love
it. As a 14, yep.
So where did the Bernie Hawk persona come from? You know, seeing you at the games, that may be how a lot of people know you, as just kind of one of those super fans that likes to dress up for the game. Where did that come from?
Well, I give credit to some of my other awesome fan friends, Neil Kiltman Hart, Jeff Ndidi, Mr. and Mrs. Seahawks, Brad Carter, the Cannonball, and others that we were at a party, and I don't think it was Seahawks, we weren't face painted up, but it was a Seahawks group related, and I was wearing sunglasses, and it was nighttime, and someone said, "You look like Weekend at Bernie." And so I did the silly Bernie dance, Bernie walked, you know, like Jerry Kaiser in the movie, and it kind of stuck. So after a while, I thought about it, and it's like, oh, I don't know about that. So I tried to. It's like, oh no, I'm Skyhawk, or I'm Air Hawk, or you know, Battle Hawk, and they're like, no, you're Bernie, and so I just adopted it.
And that's how it starts.
Yep, that's how it starts. And, you know, it's like you don't usually give yourself a nickname, so it's kind of something that you've done or something that you're known for or, you know, something that somebody's seen you do. And so I just I embraced it and, you know, made the character and started evolving the face paint and the costume a little bit. And people said, ooh, I like that. Okay, that sounds cool. You know, the hard hat kind of came along. I thought the hard hat idea was good, and sometimes I wear a hard hat, you know, at work, not a construction hard hat, but like a dome protector, because I work around equipment sometimes.
Now, you were actually at the event on Thursday where Ricardo Lockett announced his retirement, and sitting right behind Russell Wilson, I believe, if that's if that's right. And what was that like, just seeing the reaction from the fellow players and coaches and everybody there in the room?
Just the amount of love. And, I mean, we expect that from – we come to expect that from our players and our fans together and working together. So when I first got there, there wasn't very many people in the room, just media. And then the players started to come in, and then more players, and then more players, and then more players. And like I said, Russell Wilson just, I mean, I was starstruck. He just kind of came in and, you know, hey, you know, and sat down, and I'm wearing my Ricardo Lockett jersey. I heard someone say it's kind of unusual for a press conference like this for the room to be this packed. There was standing room only, and so it was wonderful seeing the smiles and seeing the expressions on the players' faces, you know, very, very innocent, very honest, you know, listening to Ricardo, you know, saying goodbye, pretty much, and all the love afterwards and all the hugs and you know, his mom and dad just very proud, and he's done, you know, he did a great job. He did a lot in the short time, you know, 5 years, not really that long for a player. But very well known with the community, very, very civic-minded, and he's going to continue that. And he's not, you know, he'll be around. We'll still see him in some events. But yeah, the room was pretty awesome.
Now, Paul, we have the Seahawkers annual banquet coming up May 21st. Adam and I going for the first time. We're really excited. Yeah. What can we expect from the Seahawkers banquet coming up?
Well, Brandon, not only can we expect, but what are we going to eat? That's my number one thing here, Paul, that I'm worried about. Like, what do we got going here at the banquet?
Well, there will be a buffet. We have special guests. Some have been announced and some have not. Some are kind of being kept under wraps.
Can we make an exclusive announcement of somebody who's going to show up that hasn't been announced anywhere else, Paul?
Not yet. I'm still waiting for that one phone call. That one phone call will kind of, you know, tip the hat, but I really don't want to.
You don't want to jinx it. No.
I don't want to jinx it, yeah.
So you have a buffet coming up. You have players that are coming. What other former players can we expect to see or any current players at this event, Paul?
We're looking at Drew Ferris. We're looking at Thurl Simon. We're looking at one of our backup quarterbacks. And if you said his name, I would keep.
Jake Heap?
Jake Heaps, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, he's coming. And then alumni, we've got Norm Johnson, of course. He's one of our favorites. He's a fan favorite, you know. And then Sarah Kessler, Seahawk Pony. Wilson, the Seahawk Pony, will be there.
Well, definitely appreciate all the work that you're doing on this, Paul. And the one thing we haven't announced, it's Armed Forces Day at the Seahawkers banquet. So we appreciate you allowing the military to be a big part of this, too.
Oh, we appreciate the military letting, you know, being there for us. You know, I believe you mentioned Honor Guard, Anthem Singer. We're looking at, you know, I think that I'm not doing the decorations, but I have a feeling there's probably going to be 1,000, you know, little American flags running around. So, yes, Armed Forces Day, got to show respect. My dad was retired lieutenant colonel in the Army. I was born in Germany. So, you know, it's all about giving back.
Oh, I guess one other thing before you go. Are there still tickets available if people want to get tickets off the Seahawkers.org website?
Thank you very much for asking. Yes, Seahawkers.org, and there's a link there for tickets for the dinner. I don't know the menu. And then there'll also be a link you can buy raffle tickets. We've got artists coming to display. We've got autographed pictures. We've got autographed footballs. Lots of great prizes. So buy raffle tickets. It all goes towards supporting, you know, the Seahawkers and keeping all the chapters going on all their charities as well. So yes, Seahawkers.org. Also the Seahawkers Facebook page. I think there's a link to bring you back to Seahawkers.org, and there'll be updates on Seahawkers.org and our Facebook page also.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the show, Paul. Can't wait for the banquet coming up, and go Hawks.
Looking forward to it. Yep. A week from Saturday, and absolutely always forever go Hawks.
Well, thanks to Paul for coming on the show. Seahawkers annual banquet coming up the 21st. And then the day after, Sunday, May 22nd, we have Hawk Fest 2016. Admission's free for this one, so definitely your wheelhouse for price range, Adam.
And absolutely, man. Yeah, that speaks to me, that price range, no doubt.
They are looking for charitable donations as part of it. $12. I know you and I will chip in our $12.
Oh, for sure.
But let's get Norb and Mark Collins in to talk about what's going on this weekend. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yep, appreciate it.
Absolutely. So we just got done talking about the Seahawkers annual banquet on the 21st, and then we have this event coming up on the 22nd. Mark, this is going to be kind of a big weekend for Seahawks fans that, you know, to get out there and be around other Seahawks fans. Kind of, you know, as we go into the summer, I think some of us are feeling some withdrawals after the draft, but this is going to help with that, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's our way of trying to make an affordable, you know, fun event for all ages. We did it last year. It's also a fundraiser for our cause, which is 12s up in 12s, and we go about out and trying to help with little things with folks. But yeah, we want to make this a very fun event and a lot of activities for the whole family, and primarily, you know, a lot of kid activities. So,
So, Norb, tell us a little bit about what people can expect when they show up at the event on the 22nd. What are some of the things, some of the events going on that that we can all experience?
There's a lot of fun stuff. You know, the event is from 1 to 5. So for 4 hours, people have the ability to do a lot of different things. At the center of it, special to Mark and I, what kind of brought us together is we're going to be up on stage performing. Mark will be performing with his band Latigo Lace, doing kind of country and rock songs. And then after that, we sort of morph some of the groups, some of my band members and Mark's, and we have the Norb Cam Jam Band. And so we'll be playing some R&B, some pop and dance music, and something that Mark generally doesn't play a lot of, but so I'm kind of showing him another side of the music side. But we love playing music, and so that's going to be kind of one of the center points of fun for the audience, just to kind of do our thing on stage for everybody. So that's a big part of it. But for the kids, Mark said the kids have lots of fun things they can do. We have these kind of inflatable football skill games that they can do. We have a mini putt-putt golf tournament that's happening. That's for all ages. Well, we have a new thing that it kind of came in after we started getting the word out there, but there's an archery, what do you call it, Mark? It's a
archery tag.
Archery tag. So I had never heard of it before, but it's really cool.
Yeah, they're going to shoot arrows at each other.
this sounds like something I can get with, yeah.
With arrows. Yeah.
Yeah, with soft tips, of course, soft tips.
Well, that kind of takes some of the fun away from it.
We definitely got an insurance release form from them, so we're all good there.
Yeah, no, it's all good fun. And, of course, we'll have a bunch of Seahawk car and truck rallies, so a lot of the really cool vehicles parked out in front. We'll also have some former players out there. Some information booths, some rally or a raffle, and auction prizes to win. So it's just kind of a lot of fun things. But the main thing is just people can hang out with other Seahawk fans and just kick it out in a beautiful location right off the water over there in Ballard, the Ballard Oaks.
I got to say, Norb, you know, you through the whole Seahawk season, you're putting out these videos, you're doing all kinds of things. I would think that the off season would be kind of your time to relax, but no. You're planning events and playing in bands at this event. It's why aren't you taking time off, Norb? I mean, let's be real.
Actually, you know, the off season is a time when it's a chance for me to do more things that I can't do during the season because it's so crazy with the games and everything. There's not a lot of extra time at all during the regular season. So in the off season, for me, it's a chance to try new videos, new events that I can do to engage with fans and to do things, functions like this where we get to, you know, help out the community a little bit, raise some money and do things for kids. It's just hard to do during the season because it's so busy. So there really is no off season. I mean, you know how it is for Seahawk fans. There really is no off season. We're always thinking about football. but for me, as through Norb Cam, it's an opportunity for me to do a little bit more, try to be a little more creative with things on video as well as events such as this. So, yeah, no time to sleep, as Russell likes to say.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
And Mark knows this is the truth, because I've had one too many all-nighters that I probably shouldn't do, but, you know, sometimes there's not enough time in the day.
So with the schedule
I sometimes ask Norma, I said, how much sleep you get? And I say, well, I went to sleep at 4 and got up at 7. I said, dude, that's going to catch up to you.
Yeah, it will.
I try not to do that too often, but, you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. But it's all in good fun, and I love it. It's a great time to be a Seahawks fan. So,
well, let's talk about that, being a great time to be a Seahawks fan, because, Mark, you were a big part of, in the 90s, the effort to save our Seahawks. You know, there was the whole movement to get the Seahawks down to Los Angeles. Ken Behring wanted to move the team down there. But you were determined to keep the Seahawks team in Seattle. And I kind of feel like we should have talked about this before. We're 112 episodes into our podcast, Mark, and we're just now talking to you about this particular piece of Seahawks history.
He's basically a savior, man.
I know. Like, that's what I'm saying.
I don't know one other 12 that has put more on the line to keep this team, you know, a part of our lives.
For people who don't know, Mark, kind of what you did in the mid-90s with that Save Our Seahawks movement, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was actually the 95 season. About every other week, there was a you know, rumor out or whatever, be on the news, whatever, that, you know, Ken Berry wanted to move the team to California, and, you know, he would continue to deny it and deny it and deny it. And then, I don't know, something snapped after watching a newscast mid-December of 95, and I watched 11 o'clock news. All of a sudden, you know, I just started typing. I said, I'm in, and, you know, writing a letter to Ken Berry in the National Football League that I'm starting Save Our Seahawks, and you're not taking my team, you know, in any way, shape, or form. Well, you know, again, he's still denying it. The original letter had to be edited a couple times per my attorney's advice. But yeah, the third draft got out. I got to the media and whatnot, and luckily enough, I was able to approach one of the best class action attorneys in the country. It turned out to be in Steve Berman's office, and they said they would take on the case if in fact Ken Berry did make the move, and he did. About 6 weeks later, after I started Save Our Seahawks, so I was prepared, and that was on February 2nd of 96. So initially, when we approached Paul, you know, in my letter in December, I suggested he sell the team to a local owner, and suggested Paul Allen, but I think again at that time. But when initially I contacted Paul's office and actually talked to his sister Jody at length on a couple occasions, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So for several months, myself and a friend of mine, Dean Aldry, you know, kept it in the public's eye. We filed a class action lawsuit, you know, pretty much did anything crazy enough to keep it on the news. And sometimes, you know, 4 or 5 nights a week, we were, you know, sometimes the top story. So eventually we got Paul to come around, and he bought an option in April of 96. But part of that was to get a new stadium. So now we were fighting, you know, to get that new stadium. And that took another 14 months. But, you know, I'm glad I did what I did. At the time, I was very green, didn't know what I was doing, never had a microphone. But, you know, basically what I did was I gave the, you know, the fans a voice when the fans really needed it. And thank God, you know, it worked out, and there's still the Seattle Seahawks.
Yeah, Mark, that is a pretty incredible story. And, you know, one thing, we just saw the St. Louis Rams move to L.A. Now, seeing that happen, do you have any sympathy for those St. Louis fans, or are you still like, well, screw you guys, you're Rams fans?
Of course I have sympathy for them. I mean, those fans, you know, the thing is, those teams have moved multiple times. I mean, they weren't even originally the L.A. Rams, you know, they did contact me, the fans down there, about a year and a half ago when they were trying to, but the problem was their lease was almost up. In my case, with the Seahawks, the NFL was somewhat on my side. For the most part, they didn't want to lose the geographical area of the Pacific Northwest. I mean, our fan base and season ticket holders and whatnot. I mean, stretched from, you know, Alaska, Oregon, Idaho, you know, your own Montana, and parts of, two provinces in Canada, you know, being British Columbia and Alberta. But so it would have been a huge loss for them. They didn't want to lose it. And the other thing is they didn't like Paul, they didn't like Ken Bearing either. So I did have a little bit of, you know, help on their end. But again, if, you know, we still, you know, a lot of people like to say I saved the Seahawks. You know, I can't say that. I just, you know, I was a voice of the fans. Paul Allen wrote the check. I just kind of helped facilitate it when it was really needed. So, I mean, I wish I could help those other folks around the country. I mean, teams, if you know, have moved on several occasions. But, you know, thank God in our case, we were able to keep them here.
Well, if you can't say it, Mark, I guess we can ask Norb on his thoughts. But Norb, maybe you could talk about too. It's pretty incredible. We think about this team, the Seahawks that we have now, and just how important it is to all of us. And they've been winning, and they've been winning for a long time since Mike Holmgren came to town. Really, we had a couple bad years, but one bad year with Holmgren, and then another bad year with Mora. But you know, before that, you think back to the early '90s when Ken Bearing was the owner of this team. That period of early '90s. Seahawks football, kind of remind people what that was like as a longtime Seahawks fan.
Well, it's for me, I've been a fan since I was a kid, and I know Mark's been a fan since beginning. So we've seen this team go through its, you know, the inception to some of the fun years under Jack Patera, and then a little flirt with playoff fun in the early 80s when we almost got to the Super Bowl. And then, yeah, the 90s came along. And it was you know, almost as bad as the Mariners for a while there, where it was just like the playoffs was just something we just didn't see, and it was just really bad teams. And that's kind of what eventually led to, you know, when Barry wanted to move the team, you know, there wasn't a lot, the fan interest was down. There was a lot of frustration for the fans and the ownership and all that stuff. So, you know, it was a very dark time. Hard to picture that now because the way the NFL is, the way the Seahawks are, I mean, the Seahawks can do no wrong. And there was a time when there was a lot of people were even apathetic. You know, they really didn't. Some people were on camera saying, yeah, I really don't care what the Seahawks stay in town. You know, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to watch these news clips and imagine people saying that, but it did have that time. And, you know, so it makes you really appreciate where they finally have gotten now under Pete Carroll and getting their first Super Bowl and really, you know, being in the playoffs every single year. I mean, we've been really spoiled now to have consecutive years where we expect it. It's almost like if we don't make the NFC Championship, it's like a letdown.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time where just making the championship game would have been like close to a dream come true. So, you know, the fans who are just kind of now, you know, jumping in and getting used to this being sort of the norm, you know, yeah, you really got to try to appreciate it because it was a long time coming before we hit this kind of level where we are considered a perennial winner. So me and Mark, we definitely appreciate it. And, you know, Mark's got a lot of more stories about how, you know, that first Super Bowl meant so much to him. But, you know, for all the fans who had to put up with those tough years, that's what made that first Super Bowl so rewarding. And so, yeah, that's why I say it's a great time to be a Seahawks fan because this will only last so long. And every team goes through the winning stages and they will go through some tough years. And you got to enjoy the being on top of the curve while you can because it doesn't last forever. So I'm just enjoying this ride and soaking it all in as we all should.
Well, how was that, Mark? Not only the first Super Bowl, but the first NFC Championship that the Seahawks hosted at CenturyLink Field, then Quest Field. What was that moment like? And you know, there are a lot of people that are fans today that probably weren't there for that first NFC Championship game against the Carolina Panthers. But that particular moment and leading to the Super Bowl, what were some of your feelings?
Well, that year, actually, I was going through some tough times. My wife was sick with cancer at the time. And, in fact, that was that game on January 22nd of 2006 was her last birthday here anyway, and then which was her 36th birthday. And so it meant a lot to me because, you know, at first her doctors didn't even want her to go to the game, but we had a friend that had a suite, put her in the suite. So she got to see that game. And again, it was her birthday. But so we didn't go to the Super Bowl because of her health issues. But since then, I wear her Seahawk coat to as many games as I possibly can, or whenever we need a coat, that is. And so when we went to the New York Super Bowl, it was my mission to take that coat there and through some from strange events, you know, my Gasoline article about what, you know, the fact that I was taking her coat, and then a famous writer, Debbie McCover, they presented me with a ticket on the 40-yard line in New York. So, I mean, that was a really big thing for me to get her coat to that game. And then, I don't know if anybody's aware, the Professional Football Fans Association is actually honoring me this summer and putting me in the Hall of Fame back in Canton, Ohio. And again, I'm going to take her coat. So for me, a lot of it is just, you know, keeping my late wife's memory alive. And because she'd be very proud of the fact that, I got her to the game. So, I mean, it means a lot to me, more than just the Seahawks games, but also on a personal level.
Yeah, it's tough when you have, you know, a fellow fan that means, you know, where the game means a lot to him. Talk to us about what kind of fan was she as a member of the 12s.
Well, my wife was a great football fan. Obviously, we met when she was slightly younger than me. But anyway, she was also a big part of Save Our Seahawks as well. So, but I mean, she was a huge Seahawks fan just as much as I was, and she loved to go to the games. Just unfortunately, she was diagnosed at the, you know, a very young age of 34, and she made it 2.5 years. But was a very strong fighter, and that's another reason why I like to give back to the community a lot in her memory. And thought, you know, whether it be through 12s Helping 12s or her own Jen, you know, Jen Collins Foundation, but. It's all about giving back, and sometimes it's the little things, you know, like I think Norb's pointed out that, you know, 12s Helping 12s, our first mission really came about with a guy that was injured in an auto accident and became paralyzed. So was last year's rally's main focus was to try and help pay for a wheelchair fan for him. So I'm just always big about helping to give back. And as Seahawks fans, I think it gives us another opportunity to do so. Sometimes it's not what you know until you know.
Norb, can you talk a little bit more about 12s Helping 12s and just kind of what this event coming up on the 22nd, what people, when they donate, kind of some of those things like the wheelchair that the funds will go toward?
Sure, yeah. Well, 12s Helping 12s, that was a little bit of background on how we formed that. It was John Bachner, actually, who we benefited last year. He's kind of the one who brought Mark and I together. The first day he and I actually met in person was the day we visited him at the hospital. We brought him some Seahawks gear. Mark got some gear donated by the Seahawks. And so we met for the first time before going up to see him. So really our first meeting was kind of started with sort of the spirit of trying to help others, and in this case, bring some goodwill to John. And as we just kind of talked about, you know, what he was doing with what he had already been doing for, you know, on behalf of his wife, helping cancer patients. And then he kind of just told me, you know, as he knew about my Norb Cam and the videos I was doing, you know, he said, you know, we should do something together, you know, put our efforts together and see if we can help, you know, do some goodwill, you know, on behalf of, you know, the name of the 12s and the Seahawks. And so we formed 12s Helping 12s for that reason. And then, you know, we had the fundraiser last year for the first one and helped John get his wheelchair van. And then after that, we just kind of continued to sort of, we didn't really have a master plan. We just knew we were going to try to keep an eye out on opportunities that we can continue to raise some money to benefit different charities and 12s in need. And so we had several things that we did last year. We did a 12 day at the Mariners, raised some money with that. We kind of did a little contest of having a go to a game with Norb and Mark and raised some money with that way. So we've just kind of been sporadically doing different things throughout the year. But we wanted to have, you know, our kind of flagship event that we do and kind of make that a tradition. And so that's what Hawkfest is next Sunday, is that kind of big rally event that, you know, it's a combination of a celebration of, you know, celebrating with other 12s during the off season, but, you know, again, having a good foundation and a purpose behind it. So the money that we raised for this this year's Hawkfest is going to benefit, you know, the 12s Helping 12s in general, but also 12s Helping the Homeless. So we have one of our members, Sarah Bryant. She goes out a couple times a month and helps raise supplies and needed things for homeless folks around the Seattle area. And so we're helping give some money to that, so help continue her cause and so she can continue to do what she's already doing. And then the money will also go help to the Ballard Elks, who they have their own charities as well. And since they're graciously donating their beautiful building to us to use for the day, it'll also go help some of their fundraising and charitable needs. So, yeah, so it's all going to good causes, and it's great that we have a lot of support by volunteers and other groups that are showing up to make this event fun. And, yeah, we just hope every year it'll get a little bit bigger. So when people like you spread the word, you know, that helps make it grow a little bit larger every time. So we're hoping to get a bigger turnout than last year and raise a little bit more money.
Man, guys, that's really amazing when we hear about what both of you guys are doing as 12s. I just want to thank you for making me feel like the laziest 12 ever. That's great. Quit raising the bar. I just usually watch the games and yell at the screen. So thanks a lot for that. No, it's great. It's great.
I mean, one thing with Mark, we did last year as well, I think you guys probably know, we had quite the fire season over in Eastern Washington this last summer with the wildfires. And And granted, you know, there was victims of the fires and whatnot, but, you know, the guys that were out fighting the fires for, you know, weeks and weeks on end, those are the guys that really needed the support. And we took over multiple trips of supplies over to those guys to support their efforts and stuff. So it's like I said, it's the little things that, you know, that, that we can do as 12s to go out and just help other folks in our community and our state and fans in general.
If people want a little more information on the event and where's the best place to go?
We have an event page on Facebook. I'd say that's probably the best place to look at. We're still in the process of setting up a official 12 Something 12 website. But at this point, if you go to 12 Something 12s on Facebook, that's where you can find out more about the group. And you'll also find our Hawkfest event page on there as well. So, yeah, on Facebook, you can find out all the information. And again, it's this coming Sunday, or I should say Sunday, May 22nd from 1 to 5 p.m. So, yeah, we hope we get a whole ton of people out there. It's going to be a great time. A lot of fun.
And on the 12s Helping 12s Facebook page, is there a place where somebody can donate or things of that nature for a lot of the Hawks fans that are, you know, not in the Washington area?
Yeah, I think there's a PayPal donation link on there. If not, we'll make sure. There was one. We need to try to probably tweak that out. But yes, you could definitely make a donation to PayPal off our site. We also have a brand new Hawkfest T-shirts, really, really cool design ones that you can purchase and we can ship out. And all that information, again, is on the 12s Open 12s Facebook page.
Very cool. Well, if people can't find that link, the other thing they can do, if they go to our page at SeahawkersPodcast.com, click the donate button there. Anything they donate here in the next week leading up to the event, we will make sure to chip it in when we make our way out there as well.
Fantastic.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for coming on the show, talking about the event May 22nd, 1 to 5 at the Ballard Elks Lodge. That's Sunday, May 22nd, 1 to 5. Mark, Norb, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you.
Yep, thanks for having us. Appreciate it. Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Well, thanks to Norb and Mark for coming on the show, talking about their event. Looking forward to that. Thanks to Paul for coming on, and Rob as well. And then Earl Lockett. Holy smokes, Adam. That was a big day of interviews.
Holy cow, man. That's a record, right?
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Yeah, man. A lot of Seahawks goodness there. And like I said, it was nice that somebody else did the heavy lifting for us this week. That was great.
Well, you know, we needed a week off. We'll let everybody else do the heavy lifting.
Oh, yeah. I totally coasted this episode.
Well, what do you say we come back and do some Do Better and Better at Life?
All right. Sounds like a plan, man.
Welcome back. This is the Seahawkers Podcast, and we're getting into the final portion of the show, and going to read some. We have one email, Adam, that I want to get into, and this one's a particular challenge to you, Adam, and then we want to get into some Do Better and Better at Life.
All right. That sounds great. I like it when the listeners write in, call in, you know, send a smoke signal, whatever it is they do to kind of, you know, keep me on my toes. Like, if they got something to call me out on, like, go for it.
Well, there's plenty of things to call you out on. It's just, you know,
right. Just you're wrong choosing, when you do it.
Just choosing which moment to do so.
Right. I mean, you can call me out. You'll just be wrong. I mean, it's not my fault.
Well, here's the email from Dave from Spartanburg, South Carolina. You can find him on Twitter at TC Seahawk. And that's the letter T, the letter C, and then the word Seahawk. So he says, hey, guys, first off, let me start by saying I love your show. I graduated law school last year in Minneapolis, and your show really helped me through.
Nice.
I listen to your shows religiously and love the opinions that you offer. That being said, I have to disagree with your disappointment of the Seahawks taking three running backs in the draft. You made the comment that we, quote, We are set at the position, but I just don't see it that way. Rawls was great in the limited role that we saw him last year, but we don't know for certain that he will just pick up where he left off. That ankle might be bothering him, and he may lose some of that explosion. Even if he is, can any team expect back to start all 16 games in a season? I think it's unlikely. Drafting CJ and Alex will be battling for serious playing time, even if Rawls is 100%. I think they plan to use CJ in a role that we've never seen in Seattle. I think he spends a decent amount of time out wide and in motion. I see him doing what they wanted Harvin to do. Alex will be the full-time downhill runner. Him and Rawls will make a great 1-2 punch that will make those defenses still respect the run. The Hawks are going to need the running game this year. That slinging around the offense we saw last year was fun, but teams have film on it now. They won't be able to shut it down, but they will make it where a running game will be instrumental in the passing game success. Finally, the third down back, or the third running back. Blah, he's from Clemson. I live in South Carolina now. I've been conditioned to throw up at the sight of any combination of that ugly orange and purple or anyone who's worn it. Keep up the good work, guys. Love your show. Thank you for making me feel at home deep in Panthers country.
That's a funny email.
Thanks, David.
David, appreciate it. If we helped you through law school, then all the better. But I will politely disagree on the running back thing, because it was a waste, and it's still a waste, and I'm still upset about it. Look, I know you understand that Rawls isn't a sure bet at running back, but here's the thing. Any player going into any year isn't a sure bet. There's guys that drop off or get better or are coming off some sort of injury almost every year. The thing with Rawls' injury is it was a broken bone. It wasn't like Jimmy Graham's injury with the torn patella, which isn't a super common injury, and not only that, but one that is difficult for guys to come back from. That's something that a guy can heal up from and is going to be as close to 100% as a guy could be. And then the idea that a guy can't play 16 games, I'm fine with that. That's what I'm saying with Chris DeMichael. He came in and showed that he could actually be a guy to fill in and be serviceable. And you already have him on your roster. And then the idea was, as I said, we should grab a guy as an undrafted free agent as another back for your third guy. That's what I mean when I say we're set. Now we're more than set. We're overset. And we've got, again, I said I understood the ProSize pick to a degree, just because he is different, has a different skill set. I think Alex Collins can be a player, but like I said, we just don't need him. We just don't. And man, look, you can have all those backs and that's great, but if you don't have anybody to open a freaking hole for him, you're going to have problems. So that's why I'm saying I would have rather had more offensive linemen to compete to try to find that best group of five guys. And that's it. That's all. That's just my personal opinion. So yeah, I guess that's my rebuttal. And since he doesn't have a mic, I get to drop it.
You have the last word. Well, I'm going to stick up for him a little bit, because where I think the need that maybe Alex Collins fills, Adam, is when you had that moment last year when Marshawn was injured, and you had Thomas Rawls in there. I felt like we didn't have the guy where if you needed 1 or 2 yards, that was just going to plow straight forward into the line and be that guy to pick up that 1 or 2 yards. I think Alex Collins will be more suited for that particular skill than maybe Thomas Rawls was.
The only thing I'd say about that is we did have that guy on the roster. His name is Will Tukuwafu. But the problem is that the offensive line was getting pushed back a yard or two in every one of those situations. So it wasn't a running back problem. It was an offensive line problem. And so you can't draft a running back to solve your offensive line problem. You have to draft offensive line, oddly enough.
I don't know. That sounds like you're thinking into it too much, Adam.
You're right. I'm sorry.
Well, what do you say we get into some do better, Adam? Who you got?
All right. Well, my do better is for Pro Football Focus. They recently came out with their top 101 players in the NFL from 2015. 7 Seahawks made the list.
Not
Richard
enough.
Sherman.
That's just not enough Seahawks.
That's not my point yet. Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett, Russell Wilson, Earl Thomas, KJ Wright, Baldwin, Cliff Averill, in that order. And here's my problem with that. And it's not so much the number. Seven's solid.
No, like, it's not enough. Not enough, Adam.
Yeah. What number do you think the highest ranking Seahawk was out of all the players in the league?
I know the answer, so I think I feel like you asked me.
But I mean, so the highest ranked Seahawk was number 23.
Which was Richard Sherman,
number 23.
Right?
It was Richard Sherman. You're trying to tell me that one of the best rosters in the league that has seven guys that made your list, not one of them cracked the top 20? Not the top 20. And not only that, Russell Wilson should have been in the top 20 just based on that. He carried a team that had no offensive line for a large part of the season. Guys, QBs ahead of him, Cam Newton, Tom Brady, Carson Palmer, and Ben Roethlisberger. Man, Carson Palmer plays in a great system. Like, there's not one person. He had great stats and everything last year. I get that. But there's not one person on God's green earth that if you were drafting quarterbacks tomorrow out of the ones available in the NFL is taking Carson Palmer before Russell Wilson. So for not having a Seahawk in the top 20, Pro Football Focus has failed and they need to do better.
Yeah, Pro Football Focus in this episode, taking a lot of heat. You know, Rob and I, we talked about them grading Jermaine Ifedi so low. So,
yeah.
Not a good time to be Pro Football Focus, or maybe a great time because they're, you know, giving us
they're getting all the
about.
Free pub. Yeah, they're getting the free pub. Hey. No, I mean, you're not having a bad day if you work for Pro Football Focus. I'm not, you know.
If we didn't have Pro Football Focus, we wouldn't have anything to complain about. We can't complain
Apparently.
About our, well, we can complain about our offensive line, but the season hasn't started yet, so we
now,
really
if it
can't
for,
complain.
If it weren't for Pro Football Focus, I'd have to watch First Take and then complain about Skip Bayless.
And you don't want to have to do that.
I don't want to have to do that. So really, in a way, they're better at life because they help me out by making me so I don't have to watch Skip Bayless. So who you got for do better, Brandon? Well, wait, what's caught your ire?
Mine is it's a quick one. It's for the Los Angeles Rams, our rivals down south mm-hmm. in California. And when I saw this image, it had me disappointed, Adam. I can expect that the Los Angeles Rams are going to advertise in their market, and maybe they want to advertise to sports fans, like at the Angels baseball game.
Right.
But they put up an advertisement for the LA Rams for tickets for their fan shop during a game against the St. Louis Cardinals. And if that's not sticking, you know, salt in the wound and
that's a little dirty
and just rubbing it in, that's a little dirty. So for the LA Rams, you know, to go dirty that early, man, do better.
Either that or they're just tone deaf, like, you know, because they're LA, they don't care about anywhere else. Right.
It could be
kind of, like LA people and New York people are very similar that way. Right. Like nothing matters outside of their little.
I'm not going to generalize to an entire community, but
I am. I have no problems doing that. Don't like either of those two cities. So there.
Well, you don't like any city that has, you know,
more than 30,000 people is too much. That is too much. And yeah, so that's just it.
Well, there you go. So, yes, for the Rams, we need to start that rivalry. Now that we have new rivals in a new town, I think we need to get that started. We need to.
They still look the same.
They do.
They still look the same. But
Can
I give a quick honorary do better here? Just because it just popped up. I have my Bleacher Report team stream up, right?
Okay.
And like, you know how you can select your teams, you know, like what you want to follow, right? But every so often they'll give you a suggested thing to follow.
Uh-huh.
They have a stream just for, quote, kicks. Shoes. Shoes.
What? There's a shoe stream?
There's a shoe stream called Kicks. Dude, if you're that into shoes, I don't know what to tell you.
You need to up your shoe game, Adam.
Yeah, look, get on a fashion blog. Get on a fashion blog. It shouldn't be on a sports page. Come on now. Come on.
Well, let's get into now the better at life. You really weren't going to nominate Pro Football Focus as your better at life. You must have something else.
I do. It's for a young man who lives in Canada. 15-year-old William, and I don't know exactly how I pronounce his last name, but it's either Godori or Godri. But anyways, he's from Quebec, and apparently a kid with some time on his hands, because he got interested in the Mayans, you know, the old school folks that you know had the calendar and the world was going to end in 2012, right?
Right.
Yeah. So he's very interested in the Mayans, and he was looking at all of the known Mayan cities, and then he also looked at a lot of the 22 star constellations that the Mayans followed. And noticed that if you overlaid a map one on the other with the known cities with the star constellations and 117 of the stars in those constellations, they lined up.
Interesting.
And he's like, that's pretty cool because once is a coincidence, twice is a trend, you know, three times is you probably. There's 117 times this matched up, right?
Yeah.
And so he's like, huh, well, that's interesting. Here's a star here that's in their deal, but I don't see a city that matches up with it. Mm-hmm. So he gets on Google Earth. He starts looking around, and lo and behold, what does he see? Things that appear to be Mayan ruins. And he worked a little bit with the Canadian Space Agency to like check out different images and things like that. They're going to put together an expedition and go check out this place. They think this 15-year-old in Canada, all over the internet, has just discovered a new Mayan city sitting in Quebec. That, wow, to me is freaking amazing. Good job, William.
How old 15. Was this kid?
15.
Wow.
15.
Kids at 15 are doing a lot different things than I think you and I were at 15.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out if I could ever get the courage to ask out one chick. Like, that's all I was doing at 15. So, to William Ghidorah, better at life than Skip Bayless. That's amazing stuff, man.
You know, instead of trying to figure that out, Adam, you could have discovered a Mayan city, and you probably would have never had to worry. Girls would be asking you out.
I know. I'm not saying I ever did it right. Like, I understand that I went about it all wrong. Yeah, no doubt about that.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Well, my better at life, you know, we started the show with Earl Lockett coming on. I think it's fitting to end the show with a better at life nomination for Ricardo Lockett. And yeah. I got a couple of quotes that I really liked hearing from him in the press conference the other day. And you know, you saw that video, all those big moments. You know, when you think about Ricardo Lockett, you think about some of the great catches that he's made. But, you know, like Earl said, you think about that block too, that he was in there on the second Beastquake run. And you think about, you know, those big hits where coming down the field on punt returns, you know, against the Rams, against the 49ers, just blowing guys up, right? And you think about that catch, the flea flicker catch over the top of the Carolina receiver in the end zone. Just some great moments from Ricardo Lockett. But you know that just based on hearing from him, he has a plan moving forward. And one of the neat things to hear from him was kind of his focus on helping people moving forward.
These guys in here aren't my worries. My worries are the woman that's in a shelter with her kids that doesn't have anywhere to go. My worry is the guy that has a doctorate or a PhD degree that's on the corner right now that just needs a little confidence or a little help, or that kid that's in school that's being bullied or being teased that could grow up and create the cure for cancer. That's my focus.
And also to hear him talk about, you know, that I jokingly referenced it as the play that we don't like to talk about, but if you're the type of person that believes things happen for a reason, it's interesting hearing from Ricardo just how much going through that particular moment helped prepare him for going through the injury and deciding to retire. If that one moment is what helped him get through that one time, you know, maybe we as Seahawks fans too, if he can take that kind of perspective that moment prepared him, you know, maybe we can take that on as ourselves too, that's something that moment did go toward something better. And here's him talking about that.
I was talking to my dad before I got here, and we was talking about all the things that I've been through. And even with that last play at the Super Bowl is, you know, it was tough for all of us to get over. You know, we're a team. We went in together, and that's what happened. But I feel like overcoming that adversity prepared me for this. It prepared me for this. So once I got to this point, I've seen adversity before. It wasn't foreign to me. It was something that I recognized, and I accepted the challenge, and now I'm getting over it.
And then the other interesting quote, and I actually broke this out against with my daughter this morning at school, because she's going through soccer. She's playing soccer, and it's just, you know, having two practices down. But she had some adversity in soccer. You know, she's very competitive, wants to win all the time. And to hear what Ricardo said about pushing through the tough times, I think this is something that when you're a parent, you look for those moments that you can pass along to your kids.
Teachable moments.
And pushing through the tough times and trying to instill that in our kids. Here's how his perspective on it.
And when I came in, I was really raw. I'm quite sure a lot of guys can tell you I couldn't get off the line. Sherm jammed me every day. I had second thoughts like, man, do I deserve to be here? Should I be here? But Kippy Brown, my coach, man, he just gave me the confidence to, he said, hey, man, just believe in yourself. Just believe in yourself. Because at a certain point, if you get beat up so many times or if you get denied so many times, you start to feel like, hey, this is not for me. But a lot of times, right when you feel like, hey, this isn't for me or I should turn around, I should stop, that's when your blessing is right there. And if I would have gave up, then there wouldn't be three Super Bowls. There wouldn't be any of that. There wouldn't be a Ricardo Lockett.
So, yeah, that idea that when you have that feeling like you're about to quit, those are the times to keep pushing. And that's what he did. And that's the reason why he became an NFL wide receiver.
Absolutely, man. And if you can pardon the pun, I mean, this is a guy who really does have his head screwed on straight. I mean, he really does. And just, I think one of the most important lessons in life, and we heard his dad talk about it a lot when we interviewed him here just before, was the handling of adversity. I think that is the number one quality in a human being. I really do. Because it's not about, I mean, handling success has its own challenges, no doubt. But handling adversity is really what it's all about. You're going to fail a lot more times in life than you're going to succeed. And I just think he's a great example for that. And then even in a situation like this, to find the positives, understand what he wants to do moving forward as far as the issues that concern him, and have the serenity of like, yeah, this chapter's over and I'm moving on to the next and it's going to be great too. It's inspirational. I mean, there's really no other way to put it, as cheesy as that sounds.
And for that inspiration, Adam, that is why Ricardo Lockett, better at life, clearly, than Skip Bayless.
Agreed, man. Agreed.
Well, a big show, Adam. Got through it this week. Thanks to everybody for coming on. And yeah, with that,
there's only one thing left to say.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.